Thank you. Well, first, let me say this is going to be, I hope, pitched to the other program, and so they're interested in plasmas and electrostatic interactions, so I'm going to tell them about the Laughlin plasma analogy, so all you HBAR guys and gals can go to sleep, and I'll wake you up when it's over. The quantum Hall effect takes place in a two-dimensional electron gas. And as we learned from Shankar's talk last week, the way you can make such a gas is to have a quantum well. Whose width is, say, 150 angstrom, and in which you can, this is a sort of position versus energy of the bottom of the conduction band, and in gallium arsenide it's lower than in aluminum arsenide, and you can arrange to put electrons into this quantum well, and there's the lowest square well state, and then there's an excited square well state that has a node, and the energy separation of those excitations is hundreds to thousands of Kelvin, and the experiments I'm going to tell you about will be at 4 Kelvin, so all the electrons will end up just being frozen in this lowest level. So the first place that quantum mechanics enters the quantum Hall effect is here. Namely, you can't make something which is literally two-dimensional, but you can make it dynamically two-dimensional because quantum mechanics freezes out the oscillations or the motion of the particles in this third direction. They're still free to move in a plane. So, I mean, imagine this table is the layer of gallium arsenide, and the electrons are free to move around in the plane of the table. But the motion this way has an excitation gap, which is basically infinity. Okay? Please interrupt if there are questions. The temperatures at which the experiments are done are 20 millikelvin, and it would be lower if we could afford better refrigerators, to 4 Kelvin. And the magnetic fields are between 3 and 30 Tesla, and they would be yet even higher fields if we could afford bigger magnets. Okay, so let me start with a brief history of electrical resistance. So in the 1850s, I think, Maxwell figured out that the impedance of the vacuum, I'm going to use CGS units on the left-hand side, Eduardo, and SI units on the right-hand side. And he figured out that the impedance of the vacuum was about 377 ohms. And that's how stealth bombers work. You just coat the surface with some junk that gives them a surface impedance of 377 ohms, and the radar waves go in and don't come back out. Don't tell anybody. It's a secret. In the 1920s, Arnold Sommerfeld figured out that this is a dimensionless number, the fine structure constant. And if that's dimensionless and this is an impedance, then it makes sense that in the 1970s, Mott, and then particularly in 1980, von Kluitzing, when he discovered the quantum Hall effect, found out that you can make, that there's a quantum of resistance which is very important in electrical transport of quantum systems and which turns out to play a central role in this quantum Hall effect, namely H over E squared has to have units of resistance, at least in the CGS system, and in SI, it's about 25,812.80 ohms. So even though these are sort of fundamental constants that you think of as very tiny, their ratio is actually a sort of laboratory-sized resistance. It's not, giga-ohms or nano-ohms. It's some reasonable-sized resistance. Okay, and this resistance turns out to play a extremely important role in the quantum Hall effect, and it can be measured. This quantity can be measured, as I'll show you. And because it can be measured, and because the speed of light is now known by definition, that was changed about 15 years ago, means that we no longer know how far apart the little marks are on the meter bar. There's always some price. But if you measure this quantity, you measure the fine structure constant. So you can make a solid-state device that has nothing to do with, you think, with quantum electrodynamics, and you can measure this fine structure constant. It's also used to maintain but not define the U.S. legal ohm.
You may want to mention that was title of
Yeah, the original, I happen to know the referee of the von Klitzing's, it wasn't me, but I happen to know the person, and he changed the title of von Klitzing's paper from a new resistance standard to a new way to measure the fine structure constant, and this probably was an actually important change for his personal history. Okay. So you hook up some electrodes to these things, viewed from the top. You send current this way, and you can measure voltage drops longitudinally, which relate to power dissipation, and you can measure voltage drops transversely, which have to do with the Hall effect, with the Lorentz force, from the very strong magnetic field perpendicular to the board, which is trying to push the carriers to one side. Okay? And you can measure a resistivity tensor. And if you had a purely classical system, as a function of magnetic field, the Hall resistivity, which relates the Hall voltage to the current density, is, again, and I'll use CGS units from now on, is a straight line, despite appearances. And it's used to measure the density of carriers N in the sample. That's what its main use was before 1980. Okay? Well, in fact, at low fields, that's actually what you see. You just see a straight line like that. But then you start seeing these little wiggles. And then at very high fields, you see these so-called Hall plateaus, where the Hall resistance, the Hall voltage divided by the current, is a universal number, independent of the what the sample is made of, the precise value of the magnetic field, what kind of disorder there is, where the impurities are, what day of the week it is, whether you're at the BIPM in Paris or you're at NIST in Gaithersburg, it's always the same. And the value of that Hall resistivity is this magic number, H over E squared, divided by a quantum number nu, which is at first was found to be an integer and later was discovered could be simple rational fractions. Okay? So there are going to be quantum numbers. This is a quantum mechanical system that has fractional quantum numbers, which is not something that we're normally used to. And at the same time that this universally quantized Hall resistance occurs, there are little the dissipation, this is rho xx, looks like this. In between the changes in the plateaus, there's some sort of quantum phase transition where it changes from one quantized value to the next in the Hall resistance. There's a little peak in the dissipation, but in here, this is extremely small dissipation, e to the minus 100 Kelvin over temperature, roughly. There's a 100 Kelvin gap, and so there was the dissipation becomes essentially zero at very low temperatures. I'll come back to that. The precision with which this is quantized, that this is, a simple integer, is 10 to the minus 10. The accuracy is 10 to the minus 8, and both of those numbers are limited by our ability to make electrical measurements, not by the properties of the samples themselves. As far as we can tell, there are no...
How do you control the amount of current going through? You can control the measure the voltage.
Well, Tony, the way you make a constant current source is you take a voltage supply and you put a giant resistor in series with it, and then independent of the impedance.
So then you have to measure the resistance very accurately.
You're asking how do they do the metrology? How do they
get this kind of accuracy?
Well, it takes several people several years, and I could give you an entire colloquium on the subject. Shankar asked me this question the other day, and he was in my office for 45 minutes while I explained.
But it's highly non-trivial.
It's highly non-trivial, and it's you can measure two different devices, like a silicon device and a gallium arsenide device. It's not that hard to do 10 to the minus 10 by comparing them. They're these superconducting current comparators. But to compare this resistance to the SI ohm, which has to be related to the meter, kilogram, and second, or now the speed of light in the kilogram and the second, that is very, very hard. And it's an interesting story, which when you have an hour, I can tell you. But I will skip for now. But let me just give you, I'm not going to talk actually about why this quantization occurs. I'll talk a little bit about why the dissipation is so low. But let me just give you a hint about why certain things like the shape of the sample. I mean, if you've ever done a Hall measurement, you know, like in a copper film or something, and you send amperes through there, and you have to have these electrodes very precisely aligned because you can mix in a little bit of the longitudinal voltage drop and so forth. None of that matters. In fact, in these samples, and you get only microvolts of signal out or something. If you sent amperes through this sample, you'd get 25,812.8 volts followed by smoke. So they usually use microamperes, right, so that they won't get hurt. And the reason is the following, that the tangent of the Hall angle, which is the angle between the current, the density vector, and the electric field, because the dissipation is so low, the tangent of the Hall angle can easily exceed 10 to the 13. So you look that up in your tangent tables, you'll see it's very close to a right angle. Okay, so what is the implication of that? Well, it's true. Imagine that you have a real sample, and these, you know, this is not some theorist pipe dream. This actually happens in real samples with solder blobs connected on them and stuff. They're really ugly looking, and they're full of junk and holes and places where the current can't go, like this. But they have one property, namely they have an edge somewhere, and at that edge, the definition of the edge is that no current is leaving there. The current has to be parallel to the edge, right? Otherwise, it's not the edge yet. Okay, so if that's the edge, and if the current is parallel to it, that means that the electric field is exactly at right angles to the edge. That means that the edge is an isopotential. So you can stick your electrodes anywhere, one here and one over there. You don't have to line them up. There's no voltage drop this way, and it doesn't matter where on the edge you stick the electrodes. It doesn't matter what the shape of the sample is, the size, that's special to two dimensions, and the lack of dissipation. Okay?
But you have to make sure the tip of the electrode is very small, then, right? Because suppose you miss the edge and put it into the bump.
The electrodes are actually big blobs that kind of do go a bit into the bulk. But
so they sample some average.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter.
You mean you may have also some crazy corrugations as well?
You can have holes in the sample. You can have, and turns out, in fact, that this whole, paradoxically, this perfect quantization and this perfect lack of dissipation only occur because the samples are imperfect and have disorder in them. The phenomenon of Anderson localization plays an essential role. I'm not going to talk about how that happens, but that's one of the amazing paradoxes of the field. If there were no disorder whatsoever, then a simple Lorentz transformation would tell you that this is rho xy, independent of whether it's classical or quantum or liquid or solid. You just go into a moving frame and you see some of the B field turned into E field and you see the density turned into current. And the ratio is just given by Lorentz transformation.
It will still be quantized, but the size of the plateau will be zero.
Right, that's right. Yeah, that's right. So in other words, yeah. So it's not amazing that there exists a value of magnetic field where the Hall resistance is exactly H over E squared. What's amazing is that there's a range 10% wide where you don't have to tune the magnetic field to a part in 10 to the 8th in order to see the precise quantization. You just land in this phase that has this property. It's quantized. Okay? All right, so...
Do you absolutely believe that even as a matter of principle, not for localization? Because if we have reservoirs from which electrons can be taken out and put back and so on, that, I mean, essentially chemical potential has to move continuously, right?
Yeah.
Through a mobility gap.
Right.
I mean, in principle, one can do that, for example, you know, by this mechanism of Barrett-Sui and Gossberg, right, where you have reservoirs and the chemical potential
readjusts. Yeah, the edge states themselves provide a small reservoir, but the width of the plateaus goes to zero as the samples get big. So, yeah.
But if you make the sample corrugated more, for instance, do you affect the width of the plateau? I mean,
yes. If it gets too corrugated, I mean, you could turn it into an insulator. You could cause a change into another one of these states, including so if the dirt gets too bad, then something can change. That's true. Yeah.
What the width is determined by what dimension?
Well, it's related to the density of states. In how fast the chemical potential jumps from one Landau level to the next is related to the density of localized states. Comparative density at the peak, roughly speaking. Yeah.
I would sort of the width actually is everything at t is equal to zero. I mean, if you really could do it.
Right. I mean, theoretically, it just becomes a sequence. It's only flat parts separated by very fast transitions in principle.
What does very fast mean?
Well, step functions.
It's so absolutely vertical.
Yeah, I mean, because it's one of these strange situations where it looks like it's some sort of first order transition, but it's just that conductance has scale dimension zero. Well, that's right. That's right. It's a very interesting function. That's right.
We've been asking not about the jump width, but about the plateau.
Right. So yeah. So these can become extremely wide in the in certain samples where it's just basically a staircase.
But how accurate is the vertical jumps measure, the slope?
Well, that's the okay. As you lower the temperature, it becomes steeper and steeper in a way that gives you a certain critical exponent, 1/2.
Is it numbers like this or?
Numbers like no. There are debates over whether it's really a power law or not really a power law. So no. Okay. So since there are people in the audience that frequently have. So there's the H in the quantum Hall effect. Let me remind you some elementary facts about quantum mechanics and high magnetic fields. So we have some kinetic energy for one particle. Let's just do one particle in a magnetic field. And you have to introduce a vector potential. It comes into the Hamiltonian like that. And the curl of the vector potential is the magnetic field. And, well, first let's think about it classically. I throw a particle out and it comes back because of the Lorentz force. I throw it harder, goes in a bigger circle, comes back in the same length of time. So there's a characteristic frequency, the cyclotron frequency, which is how cyclotrons work. And if something has a characteristic frequency like that, independent of the amplitude of the velocity, it must be a harmonic oscillator. So if you look at, so there must be energy levels of the form n plus a half h bar omega cyclotron, and this energy splitting h bar omega cyclotron is of order 100 Kelvin in typical situations. So again, it's infinity compared to the temperature as far as we're concerned. Okay? So you can have a circumstance in which, well, you say, wait a minute, I mean, I have a harmonic oscillator. There's one level there, one level there, one level there. What about the fact that I have a sample which has an area which is very big? I should have lots of states in there. And you do. It turns out that each of these levels has a degeneracy which is thermodynamically extensive. The number of levels that the degeneracy of this is proportional to the area. So what it corresponds to semi-classically is a bunch of little orbits whose circumference is an integer number of de Broglie wavelengths long, and they're packed together, and the number of those that have energy this is proportional to the area. The number that have this energy is proportional to the area. Okay? So the number of states is the area times the, this is the number of states in one of these so-called Landau levels, is the area, the magnetic field, divided by the quantum of flux, hc over e. It's like the quantum of flux in a superconductor, except it's e instead of 2e. Okay. And so the number of states per area is proportional to the magnetic field, basically because these little circular orbits get smaller and smaller because the Lorentz force gets bigger. And that defines something L called the magnetic length. Okay? I need somebody from the H bar equals zero community to nod their head or tell me to slow down or something. Okay? So it turns out that that's when you solve the quantum mechanics, that's what happens. I'm not going through the details. Okay? And this length, by the way, the size of these little mozzarellas is 200 angstroms or so. Okay? And the spacing between the electrons in this electron gas, it's not one electron for each chemical bond or something. There's a rather low density of these electrons, one every few hundred angstroms. So the spacing between the electrons and the length, this magnetic length, they're all about the same length. So they'll be, it turns out, under typical conditions, let's say only one or two or maybe three of these Landau levels will be occupied. Let's say the chemical potential is here. This gap is much bigger than the temperature, so all these states will be empty and all these states will be filled. Okay? And this is where the integer of the integer quantum Hall effect comes from. It's the integer number of Landau levels that are occupied. And each one kind of conducts in parallel and gives you a, it turns out, quantized Hall conductivity proportional to the number of filled levels. Yeah, as long as there's, it makes sense to talk about the chemical potential being pinned here, which is a tricky thing if there's a gap. You need, it turns out, some reservoir, some dirt to make localized states or something. But that's a complication I will spare the complex fluids people, even though they're used to thinking about complex things.
This number density depends on field.
Yes. Yes.
So you gave us a number for the size L.
Yeah.
That's
for a few Tesla or something. Yeah. Just sort of some typical thing. And but this number actually 1 over 2 pi L squared rises linearly with B. That's right.
And where is a few Tesla on this scale?
There, say.
Or it could be a little bit.
Or it depends, but say here, one of these places, right. Right. So, for instance, you can increase the strength of the magnetic field, say, twice as much. Then there'll be twice as many states available in the bottom lambda level. All those electrons can fall down there, and the integer will change from 2 to 1. And that's how you get this sequence of transitions, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, oops, other way around, sorry. 9, thank you, 8, 7, 6, 5. And as that quantum number goes towards infinity, then Niels Bohr tells us that's classical physics again, and you get the classical result, B over NEC. It's only when the quantum numbers are small that you can see that it's quantum mechanical, it turns out. Unless you do it upside down. Okay. So I'm not going to talk about why it turns out that this thing is quantized, but you can see at least a bit why there might be no dissipation, because there's an excitation gap. If this fluid, it turns out that there's a single particle gap. If you want, these levels are all filled, the Pauli principle won't let you move somebody from here to here. You have to make an excitation across that gap. So it seems like it's an insulator. And in some sense it is an insulator because sigma xx is zero.
But rho
xx is also zero if you invert this little 2x2 matrix. So it also seems like it's a perfect conductor. And that's because there's a collective mode where all of these guys slide together. And if it's like water, it's like an incompressible fluid flowing in a stream. If it goes past a rock, if it wants to dissipate energy, it has to excite something across this gap. And at low temperatures and low velocities, it can't do that. So it flows without dissipation. Okay? At least at zero temperature. Okay. Now, in the fractional quantum Hall effect, we evidently, since the integer was the integer number of filled lambda levels, if you raise the magnetic field very high so that all the electrons don't need to go up there, they can all fit down here. In fact, there's room to spare. Let's say this bottom lambda level is only one-third filled, for example. Then you can get this fractional Hall effect.
Now so they raise the chemical potential.
Yes, thank you. And the chemical potential goes down here. Thank you. Then you would think, well, now this is bad because now I can make, there are low energy excitations. I could move somebody from there to there. And if the fluid is flowing past a rock in the stream, it'll produce these excitations and dissipate a little bit of energy. There's no more gap. Well, it turns out that now, in order to get an excitation gap and to get the quantum Hall effect, you have to take into account the Coulomb interactions. Before, It was just a gap in the kinetic energy. You could make a kind of one body theory. But now you need a many-body theory of how all of these incredibly degenerate number of levels mix together into some special linear combination of levels which diagonalizes the Coulomb interaction. Okay, so this is degenerate perturbation theory with a 10 to the 12 by 10 to the 12 matrix. And there's only one way to do it, and that's the Bob Laughlin method. You just write down the answer. So I'm going to write down the answer for you. Okay, so we can forget about the kinetic energy. Every particle of interest has kinetic energy 1/2 h bar omega cyclotron. And there's a vast array of states, all degenerate, that they can be in. And they all get mixed together into some special coherent combination, which is the quantum Hall fluid. Okay, so let me write down for you in a particular gauge choice the eigenfunctions. There's a whole family of eigenfunctions, all of which have exactly the same energy. They all live here, same kinetic energy. So let me write down those wave functions. They have this form. Psi of x and y, so x and y is the coordinate in the two-dimensional plane, is this. I'm going to introduce a complex variable z, which is x plus iy divided by this magnetic length to make it dimensionless. So the complex number z will represent the vector position x, y. Okay? And that's nice because it turns out that f of z is any analytic function, or almost any. This thing has to have finite norm, but it's basically any polynomial, any kind of function will do. And I have this freedom because I need some kind of freedom because I have so many different possibilities that are all supposed to be degenerate. And it turns out that as long as this function is analytic in Z, it means that the particle is living in the lowest Lambda level and not the higher ones. Okay? And the freedom I have is just to specify where all the zeros of this one-body wave function are. So I can just put a zero here and here and here and here, and then when the particle moves around, the amplitude. The Gaussian is up there. When the particle moves around, it sees the wave function go to zero here, and it also sees the phase wind by 2 pi as you go around that place. Okay? And it turns out that any function of this form, any polynomial of this form, where you can put any number of zeros, you can have n can be 7 or 7 million, they can be put anywhere you want, they all have exactly this energy. Okay? Well, now we want to write down, so we've solved the one-body problem. The origin, that turns out to be a gauge choice. You can move the origin by changing the gauge. The gauge is called the symmetric gauge, first used by Landau. I don't know who first used the Landau gauge. Oh, really? Okay, good. Thank you. Fine. So the gauge choice picks out an origin. That's a good question. Turns out everything is translation invariant. Okay? Okay, so there's the one-body problem. Now, what we want to write down is a wave function for all 10 to the 12. It's about, 10 to the 11 particles or something in a square centimeter sample. Okay? And that wave function has to minimize the Coulomb energy, has to keep the particles apart, and it has to be made up of linear combinations of single body functions of this form. Sounds hard, so it is hard unless you just write the answer down, which is what Bob did. He said, what am I going to do with all these zeros? I will put the zeros seen by any given particle at the positions of all the other particles. And then I'll stay away from the other particles. Okay, so this function has the property, just freeze all the coordinates except number 7 or something, right? Then this is a polynomial in Z7 times a Gaussian in Z7. So it's a state that's in the lowest Lenda level. The kinetic energy is good. It's down here. Okay. And anytime any two particles, 7 and 11, any of them come together, the wave function has, poor choice, has an m-fold zero. So that's, the wave function gets very small, but that's the probability. Psi squared is the probability for that to happen. It's not likely that the particles will be close. That means they're staying away from each other. That means the energy is very low.
What's m?
Oh, an m. Okay, so in order for this to be analytic, m has to be an integer greater than or equal to 0. And in order to obey the Pauli principle, it has to be odd so that the whole thing will be anti-symmetric.
But just from the picture that you draw here, how do I know
So M should be viewed as a kind of variational parameter. I mean, this is a possible wave function. We want to figure out what it's like. Okay. Well,
I mean, M is one here. I mean, that was sort of the question. Mm-hmm. The way you are writing it down.
Where? Oh, yeah. So here, I mean, it turns out here, if the Lenda level is completely filled, M will turn out to be 1. If it's 1/3 filled, it will turn out to be 3. We'll come to that. Okay? So this seems like an interesting candidate wave function because it keeps all the particles apart. It vanishes rapidly if any two particles get near each other. Okay? So that's good. It turns out that it's basically the exact answer for any short-range repulsion among the particles. This is it, to extremely good accuracy. And there are model Hamiltonians with short-range interactions for which this is the unique zero-energy ground state at a certain density. Okay.
In the original argument for making L the range, why you
so in the
scale with
yeah.
Single particle L, it's becoming a property of the many particles.
Well, the reason that there's a scale L in here, this is R squared over L squared, that's just what fixes the kinetic energy to put you down in this lowest level. If this scale had a different value, then you would be in a mixture of these higher Lenda levels. You would pay some severe kinetic energy penalty to have a different scale. And this is just a product. I mean, you can break up this giant polynomial into a set of products of one-body wave functions like z1 cubed, z2 to the fifth, if I had two particles. This is just a product of two one-body wave functions that live in this lowest Lenda level. And this is just some giant product of such things. Does that make sense? Does that help? Okay. All right, so now you can ask, as we all did when we first saw this, well, that's nice, that's a wave function, but, you know, what does it mean? What are its properties? How is the density uniform? What is the density of the particles here? The energy seems like it might be good, but to really know the energy, you need to know the two-point function, the probability of having two particles a certain distance apart. And, you know, is the density uniform? I can't tell by looking at this, okay? So let's start with a simple question. What is the norm of this wave function? Okay, so I will call it Z for reasons that will become clear momentarily. Okay, so this is the part now where I hope the complex fluids people will begin to recognize something. This is psi squared, okay? M, thank you. So I've just squared this. Okay, nothing fancy yet. Now, let me write this as e to the log of this thing. Okay? E to the minus beta sum on I less than j minus m squared log vi minus c j plus 1/2 m sum on k z k squared. 1/4. Where beta is 2 over m. Okay?
2m.
Pardon?
2m.
2 over m. 2 over m. This part I know. Okay? I just took the log of this and then e to the log of that. Okay? So this you should recognize as the Boltzmann weight. This is the partition function for a two-dimensional, one-component plasma of charged rods, if you will, or point charges in two dimensions. They interact logarithmically as if they had fake charge m.
It's 2m there, probably.
There's a 2 over m times m squared, which is 2m. Okay? And the temperature appears to be 2 over m. So the plasma parameter gamma, which is beta m squared, is 2m. Okay? Now, what's this term over here? So these are particles repelling each other with so del squared minus del squared of minus log z is 2 pi. So the logarithmic interaction is the Coulomb potential in two dimensions. That's the Poisson equation with 2 pi instead of 4 pi. And then notice that minus del squared of this quantity, 1/4 r squared, is minus 1 over L squared, which is 2 pi times minus 1 over 2 pi L squared, which amazingly is this number down here, the density of states per unit area. Okay? So this looks like it has a constant Laplacian. So this looks like a neutralizing background potential from a fake charge density minus 1 over 2 pi L squared. So I have a bunch of particles, my electrons, located like this. And then there's a Jellium background of the opposite sign of fake charge. Each of these carries fake charge M. And the background has a certain density, minus 1 over 2 pi L squared. Okay? Now, what does a plasma, what is the greatest desire of every plasma? It's to be neutral. Sort of like the Switzerland of physics. So that's going to tell us what the density of particles is. I mean, where are these particles? They're wherever I want to put them to be, because quantum mechanics says put the particles wherever you want, take psi squared, that's the probability that you will find the particles at that place. Okay? So psi squared will be very, very small unless you spread the particles out until the plasma is approximately neutral. Okay? There are no forces. This is a statement about the wave function. There are no forces in the Hamiltonian that are logarithmic among the real honest-to-God Hamiltonian, right? This is just a statement about this particular variational wave function will be small unless the particles are uniformly distributed. And charge neutrality, is the following. I have a density n of particles. They each carry fake charge m. And then there's a background, 1 over 2 pi L squared. And you see the charge m interacts with that potential as 1 power of m there, which is exactly the right thing. And there are 2 powers of m there, which is exactly the right thing. Equals 0. So the density is 1 over m times 1 over 2 pi L squared. But that's the density of states that are available in the Landau level, so 1 over m of those states is occupied on average in this wave function. So the, if m is 3, the lowest Landau level is 1/3 filled. Okay, so we figured out one thing about this strange-looking wave function, namely that the particles actually, if you look, typically their density distribution is extremely homogeneous on long length scales. It's an incompressible fluid. And it's a fairly strongly coupled plasma because gamma is 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, some numbers bigger than or equal to 2. Okay, the two-point function. So what's the Coulomb energy in this wave function? Well, that's just determined. So this is a plasma problem, and I can calculate the two-point function. And it looks like that. The particles really don't like to come together. The wave function vanishes. The square of the wave function vanishes as the 2mth power of the separation. And this correlation hole lowers the Coulomb energy. A lot. Basically, you basically can't do better. This is the answer, basically. Okay. At least for these special filling factors of 1/3, 1/3, 1/5, 1/7. And there's another story about other rational fractions, which I won't get into. Okay. So now you can ask, well, this is the ground state. What about the excited states? And there are two kinds of excited states, both of which are connected to a superfluid analogy. There is, it turns out, a density wave excited state, much like in superfluid helium. It has its roton minimum, but it has a gap associated with the fact that this is an incompressible system. Those neutral excitations are kind of phonons, have a gap. Then there's another kind of excitation, which I'll talk now in some detail about, which is a vortex. So this is, there exists underlying this a kind of order parameter that makes it look a little bit like a superfluid. And in, you can make an excitation on top of this state, which is a kind of vortex. And this vortex has a very strange property, which we will get to shortly. Okay, so suppose I wanted to make a vortex. Well, I would take the following wave function. I would take every particle, j equals 1 to n, zj, and I would give them all an extra zero at the same place. So let me call this psi sub m. So I take the ground state wave function in the best spirit of variational quantum mechanics, and you want to find a good excited state, you start with the ground state as a factor to build in lots of good correlations, and then you do something to make it different. And this factor, what it does is every particle, when it goes around this place z, the phase of the wave function winds by 2 pi. So that's what a vortex is, right? It's some sort of topological singularity that you can detect through this phase winding. So again, It turns out that this is a very good wave function. Instead of having all of the zeros that any given guy sees on the positions of the other particles, there's an additional zero at this position z. Okay? So this is the ground state for one more zero added, one more flux, if you will. Yeah. So the so let's do the plasma analogy again and see what we get. Well, I have this as a factor, the same as before. So that'll be this thing over here. I'll call U, the energy of the classical plasma. Okay. And then there's this term, which I'll call e to the minus beta v. And v turns out to be sum on j equals 1 to n m minus log zj minus z. Yes. Okay. It's a beta. It's 2 over m. So. Beta is 2 over m, so it's actually 2 is the actual coefficient in minus beta v when I square the wave function. Yeah.
Do you violate the vector neutrality? It looks like you're putting additional rho there at that point.
Very good question. Okay, so what happens? It looks like this perturbation looks like charge m objects seeing an extra charge 1 object located at that place. So I've inserted an impurity, have all these charge M guys running around, and then there's one charge 1 guy there. So the most likely configuration is one that's charge neutral. Okay? So what happens? There's a screening cloud around this impurity in which the extra charge M is 1 over M. The extra charge 1 is removed from the screening cloud to make it charge neutral. But that means that the amount of fermion number, the amount of number of electrons that have moved out is 1 over m. Okay? So the fermion number or the actual honest-to-goodness Coulomb charge in there of the electrons, there's 1 over m of an electron charge. There's 1 over m of an electron missing from this place. So these objects have fractional charge. So that should bother you. Okay, so I'm going to, in case it does bother you, I'm going to try to explain why it's okay. So, Shankar Dasarma looked up some material that has dielectric constant exactly 3 at some temperature. I don't know, remember what it was. But carbon trisulfide at some temperature has dielectric constant 3.000. Is that what this is? Is this just some medium that has a quantized dielectric constant and it just looks like when you put in this object, there's charge 1/3 there, or say the number of the electron change is minus 1/3 there and plus 1/3 on the surface. That actually is what happens. That's where the other bit of the charge goes, out to the surface. Everything is pushed out. And that's what happens in a material, in some sense, that has dielectric constant 3. And the answer is no, this is not the same thing, because if you take a sample of this quantum Hall fluid, and you put an electron here, it can break up into 3 of these charge 1/3 objects. And you can send them through the fluid to the other side, actually, one at a time. Whereas in a material that has dielectric constant 3, you can send an electron through to the other side. It's true, it looks kind of like it has charge E over 3, but the current, that you know, the change in the charge, and it moves from one side to the other, is there's a whole electron that went with it. Here, these breaks up into three charge one-third objects, each of which can move independently, and you can measure the shot noise for when the current flows across there, and it's one-third as big. Smaller units of charge are crossing, and that experiment has actually been done recently. You can also measure the charge of these things with a very tiny electrometer, which is another amazing feat. So what's going on? I mean, how can you have in a system made up of electrons, how can you have something that has fractional charge? And I want to try to tell you a story about that. Some people in the room have heard this from me several times. John Chalker heard it within the last few weeks. So,
could you remind once more the definition of M?
Yeah, M.
After that, everything is so simple.
Right. So M enters this wave function, Zi minus Zj to the M. And it sort of looks like a variational parameter, but in fact, it just sets the density to be one-third of a filled lambda level, one-fifth, one-seventh, if M is 3, 5, 7.
Is it running parameter or is it one fixed parameter?
It has to be, in order to, okay. It has to be an integer and it has to be odd in order for this to be a good wave function. Now that's a statement about the wave function, not about the physics. It's a statement about Bob Laughlin was able to think of these wave functions, and they happen to have occur at filling factors one-third, one, one-third, one-fifth, one-seventh, and that happened to be the most important fractions that were first discovered.
The wave function is not the sum over M.
No.
One.
No, because they differ macroscopically in their density, and so M is fixed. Mm-hmm. Okay? Okay, so first I'm going to tell you what is not fractional charge. I'm going to set up a straw man, straw person, and knock it over. Okay, so imagine I had three protons. Okay, one, two, and three. And I consider just the Hilbert space of the 1s orbitals on those three protons. And I have one electron, and it can tunnel back and forth among those three guys, right? Well, if I look at the ground state of this, there'll be some plane wave-like solution with equal amplitudes on each place. I measure the charge. The average charge will be one-third on a given site. But the actual distribution, the probability function, will be the probability of getting zero will be two-thirds, and the probability of getting one will be one-third. And the number fluctuations are big. Okay? They're larger than the mean by a factor of root 2. And so this is not real fractional charge because it's just, you know, integers fluctuating around between 0 and 1. Sometimes I measure and there's no electron there two-thirds of the time, because it's over there. One-third of the time it is there, so the average is a third. Now, what's the time scale for these fluctuations? Well, that's the time if I set up an electron on this orbital. It's not in one of the eigenstates. It's in a linear combination of the three eigenstates, and they're very nearly degenerate. And the splitting is something like e to the minus r over a Bohr, or twice e to the minus 2r over a Bohr. It's very, very small, and the corresponding fluctuation time is exponentially large as I move these guys apart. And that's a signature of fake fractional charge, because the fluctuations get slower and slower and slower. They're easier and easier to detect, and it's just lots of fluctuations. So that's not real fractional charge. Now I want to convince you that these guys are real fractional charge, okay? Because they do something very different from this. Namely, if I now put vortices here, Laughlin quasiparticles, each of which I claimed had charge one-third, okay? If I look at the quantum Hamiltonian in this situation, in a quantum Hall fluid. So there's quantum Hall fluid everywhere, and then I put one of these vortex defects there, there, and there, and each one I claim has charge one-third. If I look at the spectrum of the Hamiltonian, it looks like this. There's a ground state. If I pin the positions of these guys, there's a unique ground state, and then there's a gap of about 10 Kelvin and then a continuum. You don't see a threefold near degeneracy in the ground state. The state of the system is uniquely specified by the positions of the vortices, whereas in the hydrogen analog, if I tell you the positions of the protons, that does not uniquely specify the position, the state of the system, because I have to find out which one of these three nearly degenerate states I'm in. There's some freedom left. Okay? That's not true here. This is uniquely specified. That means that these are true elementary particles. If I just say where they are, there are some kind of degree of freedom, and there's no additional underlying thing I have to specify. Okay? So that's difference number one. Difference number two is, because this gap stays finite, even if I put these a mile apart, then the frequency with which the charge fluctuates is given by this gap. It's 200 gigahertz. Okay? And I don't have any voltmeters that can detect electrometers that have a bandwidth of 200 gigahertz to see those fluctuations.
This gap is a purely temperature effect? No.
This gap is from the topological order in the underlying.
What? In terms of number,
what?
Huh? That's the fraction of quantum.
Yeah. No. Right. Right.
I guess I was just confused because I was looking at the 10K.
Well, it's 10K.
That's just what it was.
Right.
Yeah.
It's 10K. Now, so what that means is that if you want to put a box around here and close the box up suddenly and count how many electrons are in there, you're going to get an integer number. But in order to do that, you have to destroy this condensate, and you have to pay at least this much price in energy. Okay? Now, this is only 10 Kelvin. If this is about 1 millielectron volt. If I told you that it was 1 GeV, you'd say, wow, these things have sharp charge. In order to see any kind of fluctuations, virtual electron-positron pairs around them or something, I would have to build a particle accelerator and probe the interior of this object to see any kind of fluctuations. The fact that the physics is continuous all the way down to 1 millielectron volt, as long as the gap remains finite when they come apart, it's should be viewed as true fractional charge, which is not fluctuating, at least on any time scale that I can see with my apparatus. Okay, and that's the fundamental difference between those two things. So, let me tell you a little allegory to kind of bring this point home. Apologies to those of you who have heard it, but imagine that you live in flatland. You live in this two-dimensional world. It's very cold, it's very dark, and you've been living there all your life, and all you know is this is like this inert vacuum around you. You can't see anything. And now there are these rumors that in the distant past there was something called the Big Cool Down at the beginning of the universe, where things suddenly got dark and cold, okay? And then flatland cosmologists have some little telescopes and they're looking out and they see some objects out there, some sort of cosmic strings that are theorized to have been left over from the beginning of the big cool down. And there's some topological defect that just got frozen in, okay? And some flatland version of Benjamin Franklin decides these things are charged. And he sets up the sign convention so they have charge minus one-third. For some reason, the Flatlanders go along with this. Okay. So then Flatland experimentalists say, well, we're going to do an experiment to see what's inside these things, to see if they really have some structure inside them. And so a huge amount of money is raised to build a particle accelerator. And they smash three of these things together, okay? And incredibly, some object appears out of this mess that has the amazing property of having integer charge. And it lives for a little while, goes off, and then it breaks up into three ordinary guys that have the usual property of having charge one-third. That's right. That's right. So, the point is that if 10 Kelvin looks big to you, then they have sharp charge.
Do you explain that this, okay, this, you say that's a real particle, but you explain that you get this particle by excitation. You started to build the wave function, which was ground state, and you came to the first lowest lying excited state.
Right.
So in that sense, it's not really a particle, it's a quasi-particle.
Yes, it's a quasi-particle.
First excitation.
That's right. It's an elementary excitation of a quantum condensate made of electrons, which has the property of carrying charge one-third.
You may mention that they are sort of free and come up at the edge.
Yeah, so I don't know whether Matthew may give a talk on this later or not, I don't know, but the... he claims to have already given it, okay. Well, it turns out that if you make a quantum Hall device with an edge, okay, so you have this nu equals one-third fluid, in order to make one of these quasi-particles inside there, you have the creation energy, which is on this scale of a few Kelvin. Okay, but in some sense, they're kind of liberated at the edge and moving along. And you can do an experiment, and it has been done recently, in which you take a piece of metal and you tunnel an electron across a gap into this fluid, and it breaks up into three of these objects. And the way it does that produces a very characteristic non-linearity in the current voltage characteristic of this tunnel junction. And there are some aspects of this which we now don't understand, actually. So maybe it's a... But at filling factor one-third, we do understand it, or we think we do. And you can see these guys. You can also, if you make a narrow place, as I mentioned before, if you make a narrow place where these edges come near each other, these vortices or fractional charged objects can move from one side to the other. So you're never violating charge conservation by having one-third appear out of nowhere or something. You're just moving one-third from one edge to the other. And you can measure the shot noise for that process as they stochastically go across, and it's one-third as big as it would be if they were electrons going across.
Can you measure some kind of plasma frequency with one-third change to the coefficient?
It's sort of, except that there are very large renormalizations of that frequency. I mean, that's actually unfortunately, there are a lot of simple theories of what's going on where you make that assumption that you just get a plasmon of these guys at one-third the frequency, and that's not correct. There's extremely large renormalizations of that for complicated reasons that...
Bob, if you were here, I've said many things. one of which obviously have been that the fact that the fractional charge is manifested in the very first experiment, the fractional quantum Hall plateau itself.
That's right.
The fact that the plateau is fractionally quantized.
Right. There's a very deep argument, which took me a while to appreciate, but I think I'm beginning to understand, that the existence of a fractional quantum number in the quantized value of the Hall conductivity, you can show leads directly and necessarily to the existence of charge one-third objects that are true elementary excitations in the system. Okay, I'll stop there. Thanks.
Any more questions?
That's right. That's right. So various fractions have been seen, one-third, one-fifth, one-seventh, you know, two-ninths, three-elevenths, five-halves. There's a bunch. Yeah.
Well, thanks again.